You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Welcome to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to the show, made possible by our friends at Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Today, we're joined by the only Australian to play for fabled Italian football giants AC Milan. Jaco Kalac was a Champions League winner in Milan, making more than 400 appearances for his clubs and his country as a towering goalkeeper. The man known as Spider enjoyed a 20-plus year career between the posts, from Australia to England to the Netherlands, Italy and Greece, sharing locker rooms with some of the biggest names in the history of the game. In retirement, he's turned to management in recent years. Jaco, it's a great pleasure to have you on, and thanks for joining us.
How are you guys? Pleasure.
Now, how's my pronunciation, firstly, because I was at pains to try and nail it and not Australianise it, you know, Zalco. Am I at least a 5 out of 10?
Well, I mean, you're getting the Z in, not bad. So the Croatians would say Zalco, the Aussies would say Zalco, and the ones who don't know start stuttering and go Z, and I go, that's just me.
They roll with Spider if they're in doubt, perhaps.
Yeah, Spider's the best one. Zalco, when someone calls me Zalco, it's no good. I've been up to no good, so I'm in trouble for that. So while people call me Spider, I'm happy to go on with it.
Or roll with it. So Spider, Jaco, where do we find you? How do we find you? Where are you at the moment?
Mate, I'm in Sydney, back in Sydney, enjoying coaching and just enjoying being back home in Australia.
I want to get to your thoughts on the coaching in a moment. Before we do, we're speaking about, I think, about a month out from a historic football game to be played at Optus Stadium in Perth. For the first time, two of Italy's most historic teams are clashing on these shores. Your AC Milan and AS Roma. This is literally a once-in-a-lifetime event, and you're on the spruiking front lines, aren't you?
Yeah, no, it's brilliant. It's exciting. I wish we could have got out to Australia when I was playing at Milan, but to finally get them out here, I think people will be really surprised to go out and watch two Italian giants play here in Australia. The quality of football and the quality of player in these two teams is enormous. And to get the opportunities that they're going to get at this game in Perth, to be able to watch them train, which is something that is very, very difficult over there, as people would know, and to see it firsthand for as many open sessions as possible, I think people should get it out there and have a look how good these players are.
You touched on it there, but during your playing days at the San Siro and obviously training out at Milanello, weren't you always telling the Milan guys that they should play a friendly out here?
Mate, I tried my best, but it was just hard at those times. I mean, it was probably where the money was. We played a lot of games in the UAE and Moscow and stuff like that Well, I think we went to Albania twice, actually, so I can imagine what they got paid for us to go out there and play. So I think it was all down to money and timing, really.
So the management space nowadays, you're in charge at Sydney United 58, which does have, for those unfamiliar, a really rich history of producing fantastic players, international players. And you were named as one of the, I think, the 8 foundation clubs, you'd call it, for the inaugural national second tier to commence this time next year. Where's that at the moment, Jaco? Do they want to get to 12 teams, a final series as well?
Yeah, look, I'm hearing they want to get to 12 teams. At the moment, there's 8 that have confirmed, so I still think they've got some work to do, and hopefully it gets moving closer. What are we, April now? So we're about a year away from it commencing. So there's still a bit of work to be done to finalise everything.
That's exciting. So many people have wanted this for so long. And just on management, I think it's fair to say, I'd love your thoughts on this, you're doing the management at a very different world to the one you lived as a professional player. I mean, you can't say and do the things perhaps some managers did when you had the boots on. So even in these early days at Sydney United, I think you're pretty old school. Has that been a challenge for you, Spider?
Look, I think the game's evolved. I try to implement now the things that I learnt along the way and working with these players that that are at this level, all you can try to do is actually try to make them actually appreciate what they do for a job. And, you know, a lot of the times I speak to our players and I say to them, you know, I didn't choose this. You guys chose this. My job is to actually get the best out of you and to make you the best player you can possibly be. And let's see where it takes you. You know, does it take you to A-League? Does it give you an opportunity to go overseas? Does it make you one of the best players at this level? And I think we've gone away from a little bit of all of that. In football in general, like I think coaches these days, all we can try to do is through our experience, make the individual players the best we can so they have the best career they can have.
So you managed briefly in Croatia and back here with some of the, I guess, next generation of player. But there's the ranting and raving. We're told the ranting and raving doesn't work with the younger generation anyway.
Oh, yeah, they still cop it. Right. Yeah, they still cop it. And it works. Don't worry about that.
Right. Okay.
It works. Look, they are softer than what we were. That's for sure. But I mean, I don't think it's something you can do every single day, Adam. But I think if you're fair and when it's called for and you use it, it does get a reaction.
Nice. So Sydney 58, there's a Kalach in goal, of course, isn't there? Still, has Oliver still got the gloves on, your son?
Yeah, yeah. Ollie come back this year. So he was in Europe for 2.5 years and I finally managed to drag him back. Wasn't easy. He didn't want to really come back to Australia, but we got him back here and he's doing really well at the moment. We're 10 games in. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes you need to come back. You know, the old saying, out of sight, out of mind. And that's what happens here in Australia. Like, you can be playing overseas, but no one knows what you're doing. And we're so far away. And I think as a young kid, sometimes they can get lost in Europe because there's no one guiding them. And I think sometimes it's good to come back and be with family and friends and surroundings that you know just to restabilize yourself and go again. And it's funny because my career, I actually did the same thing. I was in Croatia. It was very hard. I come back to Australia, I think, for 6 months and then went back overseas. So yeah, I think it's good platform to bounce off and go again.
Now, being a parent's great, I know, but it's also complex. It can be difficult. I imagine being a manager is great, but it can be complex and it can be difficult. What's it like being both to Ollie?
Look, it is difficult. I try to be a coach first when we're in the dressing room and then try to treat him as equally. I'm probably more harsh on him than I am the other players, which has its good and its bad. My dad was the same with me. But I think I can give him good guidance and from experiences that I had in my career. But at the end of the day, they've got to have the quality. And they've got to have the drive and the want and the burning desire inside of them to do the extra work as well.
Does he?
Yeah, he does. He does need to kick up the backside every now and then to do it. But he does. He works hard. He's growing and he's a very young goalkeeper, like 21. Like not many goalkeepers are playing at 21 at this level.
Yep.
And he's growing game by game and each experience he's developing. And that's what we're trying to do at our club, get the next generation of players developed and get them ready for the B League or possibly A League.
That's great to hear. Sam Edmund with you, and you're listening to This Is Your Journey, thanks to Tobin Brothers, a family-owned business since 1934. So from growing up in the Sydney Croat community to the National Soccer League and beyond, we'll retrace the rise of Jaco Kalach after this.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, great to have your company on This Is Your Journey. It's made possible by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We're with former Socceroos and AC Milan goalkeeper Jaco Kalach, although I'm persisting with the Jaco. Maybe by the end of the program, Spider, I'll have a grasp of it, maybe. Let's go back for a second. What are your memories of childhood? Take me back to the early days.
The early days were fantastic, actually. It was, I played for a small club called Ludnam Croatia, where my father was the coach. Obviously, Croatian community, and, you know, you couldn't wait for the weekends to come, and it was all about football Saturday and Sunday. There was no loadings back then. It was play Saturday, Sunday. You know, go out to people's houses, barbecues after the game. If we won, McDonald's. You know, if we lost, we got KFC. So it was like always a family affair and people around each other. And, you know, they were actually great days. And big change now compared to then. Like, you don't see so much the families sticking together after a match and doing those kind of things anymore. It's all... where can I get my son to, or my daughter to, or what level can I get him to?
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? I was going to ask you about that upbringing as an Australian Croatian, what that looked like. Was it a close-knit community?
Very close-knit. We had our clubs, like there was King Tom, there was Hurstville Zagreb, there was Ludnam Croatia, and the pinnacle of it all was Sydney United, and we all supported Sydney United. So, you know, that was your weekend. Your weekend was playing for your club teams, and then Sunday afternoon going to follow Sydney United wherever they played. And that was and that's what it was all about in my childhood growing up. Football, football, football.
Yeah. So 13 you joined Sydney United. By 16 you're playing. I think the first choice, Tony Franklin, was injured. He might have had an ACL. So you came in, got a good run at it, and you never look back.
Yeah, it was. I was one of the lucky ones, you know, and that's what I think a lot of people these days as well. Ronnie Corrie gave, I think, six or seven of us a great opportunity while we were young, and he took the brunt of it. And you know what it's like. People always have an opinion. You know, the plumber has an opinion, the electrician has an opinion, and I remember Ronnie tells the story well. He used to say, you know, they used to come up to him and say, you can't play Kulutz. He's no good. He's no good. You can't play Kulutz. And, you know, Ronnie persisted with me. And funny enough, Sydney United sold Kulutz for the most money they've ever sold anyone out of Australia. So it just shows that you need to leave the football stuff to the football people, and the tradies need to do their tradie work.
Obviously, to do what you did and the level you got to, Zheko, you need the talent, the drive, all the things I've already mentioned, but you need good people in your corner too, who now perhaps in your current vintage you can look back on now with a real appreciation of the time and the devotion they had to you. Was Ron Corrie certainly one of those?
Yeah, Ronnie Corrie was a huge figure in my success. He worked me hard and gave me an opportunity at a young age. I think I was training with Sydney United first grade when I was 14. I was already training with them, and I was lucky to have the guys like Steve Watson, Greg Woodhouse, Tony Franken training there at the time. So I was getting a lot of experience training with these guys at a young age. And, you know, my father played a massive part as well, because you know, he was quite hard on me as well. It's funny, you know, we spoke about me coaching Oliver now, but, you know, your father is coaching you as a coach, but he's actually guiding you as a father and asking you to do those extra things as well. It's funny how you can never make him happy. Eh? Yes. It doesn't matter how good you play, they always come up with something that was no good. And, you know, I look at myself now with how my father was. You know, I'd sit in the car and I'd go, far out, I played tops. He's going to tell me how good I was, and then he'll say to me, but what'd you kick that ball out for? You know, and I'm a little bit like that now with Oliver, but I think that's good. I think that always gets him to drive and go further and get better and not be complacent and not be satisfied with good performances.
So you're listed as 202 centimetres. Did you shoot up early as a kid, or were you a late bloomer?
About 16, 17, I started to grow, but I was so gangly, mate. That's how I got the nickname Spider. Graham Arnold gave me that name, Spider. I was like a bloody daddy long legs. There was nothing of me. I was tall, gangly. There wasn't much figure about me at that time. So, you know, and my reach helped me make a lot of saves at that time. So that's how I got the nickname Spider. Yeah, but it was about 16, 17 where I had a decent spurt.
Yep. So your generation of player, and it might still be the case for all I know, but you were brought up being told you just had to get to England. You had to get to the UK to evolve as a player. Now, you did. You played briefly for Leicester, but you couldn't get a UK work permit and you couldn't stay. What happened there, and how frustrating was this chapter in your life?
Yeah, that was a disaster, actually. But it was really different back then, because we weren't as ranked as high, the Socceroos, and there was some silly rule, but we only played about 10 games a year. You know, so we didn't play many games, and you had to play like 75% of the matches in a certain category of matches, which we didn't play. So it was really difficult. And the work permit for a lot of us trying to get into England back then was very difficult. That fell through. I finally got to Leicester, but I missed such a long period of the season because of the work permit that they didn't reissue my work permit for the next year. So then I ended up coming back to Australia for, I can't remember how long it was, 6 months, I think. And then I ended up going back to Rota.
Yeah. And I mean, you came back, as you said, you left for a transfer record, and within 6 months you're back. I think you later said England was, and the red tape there nearly destroyed your career.
Mate, it was, honestly, it was heartbreaking. And that's what I say about young kids these days. And, you know, in hindsight, I look at it now, I was very lucky. Because I could have got lost in the English game at such a young age, because it really is a dog-eat-dog world over there. And, you know, I probably wasn't ready to play at that level yet, but I needed time, which I didn't get the time to develop over there because of the red tape. So I think we have to be careful with this generation of picking the places. First and foremost, you need to be good enough. And second of all, you need someone that wants to buy you or that's willing to give you an opportunity. But you need to go into countries where you can actually play and develop as a player, because it's a big jump from the A-League, or, you know, back in our day it was the NSL, and it's a huge jump from that to European football.
Yeah. So you mentioned the Netherlands. You went to Roda. You had four great years there, didn't you? And you were close to the Champions League at least in two of those 4 years. You won the Dutch Cup without conceding, which was great. Was the frustration the club didn't end up investing into the future and when their playing list and such the main reason that you moved on from Roda?
Man, you've done some homework, haven't you? You've done some homework there. Roda was a great club. Like, we were probably, when I was there, it was probably ranked about the fifth to the eighth club in the league. And we overachieved. We had a great group of guys. We had a really good coach, Seth Ferguson, a Dutch guy, really good coach. We had a great team. And we just fell short twice in the last game of the season against a team that was like our hoodoo team, RKC Waalwijk. They used to always fight for relegation, and we could never beat them. And they cost us 2 years in a row, like Champions League. But as you said, we won the Dutch Cup without conceding. That was a fantastic achievement. And after the 4 years, like, it's funny, ain't it, how in football things lead you somewhere. So we played, Roda played Milan in the quarterfinals of the UEFA Cup, and that was the first time Milan had seen me. So all my moves started to happen after that performance against Milan for Roda. Milan kept their eyes on me for a while, but Perugia ended up buying me first. And then from Perugia, I went to Milan as soon as the opportunity arose. So, you know, but Holland, I think, was a great, great stepping stone for me and through my career.
Amazing what you touch on there. So you need, in terms of the recipe, you need ability, you need drive, you need talent. We mentioned Corey, so you need good people in your corner. And then sometimes, look, you just need to be in the right place at the right time. And that was you maybe with AC Milan when you made a number of big saves in that match as well.
Yeah, well, look, that was, you know what, and the big clubs, they've got all the analysis and all the data of all the players around the world. And, you know, back then Milan was probably ahead of anyone else with facilities and the way they trained and Milan Lab and everything that they had. But they were such a great club that there was no room, and they wanted to actually see how I would perform in the Serie A. And Perugia, to be fair, they were the ones who gave me the opportunity to go into the Serie A and bought me from Roda. Touched on it before. I probably would never have left Roda had they invested and wanted to go into the Champions League. But obviously, there was the Ajaxes, the PSVs, the Feyenoords. Twente was strong back then. Heerenveen was really strong. So there was teams that spent budget a lot bigger than what Roda's were, and it started to get frustrating. And that was the only reason I ended up leaving Roda, is because I wanted to challenge myself. I wanted to play at a higher level.
Yeah.
And to go into Serie A at that time was such a strong league and was a huge jump from the Dutch Eredivisie to go into Serie A. Not many players did that jump. So it was a massive opportunity and a massive challenge.
So before we get to the break in AC Milan, it was Italy next with Perugia, as you mentioned. So the team ended up getting relegated to Serie B, and they'd gone bankrupt. Am I right in saying here that they refused to sell you for a time, but you'd also had not been paid for the better part of 12 months at one stage?
Yeah, it was actually funny because we had such a good team, obviously, and we'd done really well. And then something happened with the owner, Gaucci, and you could see the tide turning and you could see what was happening. And then we had a playoff game against Fiorentina. And yeah, Fiorentina's a much bigger club than what Perugia was at the time. So, you know, the writing was on the wall that we were in big trouble. We ended up getting relegated. And then I could have went to Roma, where Capello was, and I could have went to Fiorentina. And Perugia didn't want to sell me at the time because they believed they could come up, they could come straight back up. But yeah, it was not looking good at the club. And then we ended up playing that year. It was a very topsy-turvy year. I ended up coming back constantly with the national team and going there. And every time I'd come back, they would lose 5-6 games. And then I'd go back and we'd go back up to the table. And then I'd go away with the national team and I'd lose again. And then we got to the playoffs and they owed us a year's wages and they were promising, like, you know, monthly that they would pay, and they didn't. I actually just refused to play in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And yeah, and they obviously we didn't get promoted. And then I went away with the national team, and then I got the phone call, a very funny phone call while I was away with the Confederations Cup, where a manager called me and said, look, I've got a club for you, one of the big clubs in Italy. Are you interested? And I said, well, that's great that I'm interested, but what's the name of the club? And he didn't want to tell me the name of the club. I said, well, how am I going to know if I'm interested if you don't tell me the name of the club? So he tells me AC Milan, and I just hung up the phone. I thought he was taking the piss. You know, so
your
manager rings you,
and you think he's pranking you.
Yeah, so I just hang up, and he rings me back. He goes, don't hang up. It's true. I'll be in Germany tomorrow to see you and have the conversation. And yeah, it was true. They were there the next day, and they said, look, we want you. We just got to wait now to see what happens with Perugia, whether they stay alive. If they stay alive, we'll buy you. And if they go bankrupt, well, then you come to us. And that was it. And that was my move to Milan.
Jeez. We're with Jaco Kalac on This Is Your Journey. It's thanks to Tubman Brothers Funeral celebrating live. So as you've heard, AC Milan have come calling. Life at the San Siro is up next.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hello, we hope you're enjoying this week's edition of This Is Your Journey. Today's guest is a Champions League winner, a long-time Socceroos shot stopper. We're with Spider Kalac. So, Spider, AC Milan come for you, even after you determine that your manager's not pranking you with the phone call. But the Brazilian keeper Dida is at AC Milan, of course. He's the resident number one. He's the 2003 Champions League final shootout legend. He's, I guess, standing has never been higher. So for you, the decision to be the man at a club like Roma or back up at one of the world's biggest clubs like AC Milan, did you have to wrestle with that at all or not even a conversation for you?
Look, I probably spent a day thinking about it because, you know, Roma and Fiorentina were both two very good clubs. And I can't remember exactly. I think Fiorentina offered 2 million to Perugia, and then Perugia just kept on playing silly buggers with them and kept on lifting the price. Every time they made a phone call, they kept on lifting the price. And it sort of got complicated there. And then I thought about it. And I'm a childhood Milan supporter. So, and I just thought to myself, mate, who's ever going to get to Milan? You know, like I was raised in Mount Druitt. and to end up playing for a club like Milan, I just said, you know what, I've got to take my chances. I was 32 at the time. I thought I was a top keeper until I got to Milan, but I actually thought I was a top keeper and seeing the way Dida worked. And I just said, you know what, I'm going to go fight at Milan and use this opportunity and try to be the best keeper I can be at a club like that. And that was the choice, to go and be second keeper and to be ready to do my job.
So about 45 minutes outside Milan lies Milanello, the training centre. It's like the world's very best botanical gardens, isn't it? The landscaping is unbelievable there. It's like an oil painting. And the picture of the Flying Dutchman's up there as you walk in, Van Basten, Hulett, Rijkaard. And in that dressing room at the time are guys like Pirlo, Seedorf, Kaká, the list goes on. I can't imagine what that was like. Even for someone at the age of 32, and you'd seen a bit of football around the world by this point, the head must have been spinning.
Yeah, it was pretty surreal, to be honest. Like, I arrived, I remember the day I arrived, you know, they had security guards with guns at the entrance, and it was the full kit and caboodle of, I've never seen a soccer ground like that or a training ground like that. And then you walk in and you see all those magnificent players that you watched on TV for so many years, and to actually be a part of it. And then you get there and you have the coffee straight away and you have a look over the fields and all the facilities, and you just think, wow, you know, this is so surreal. And to be a part of that, but the funny thing was they were all so welcoming. Like, you know, and they all remembered the games that I played against Milan, whether it was for Roda or whether it was for Perugia. You know, they knew everything about your career. They were on top of everything, but they were really welcoming. The players were fantastic. They were a great bunch. It was such a good group of players, and the dressing room was so united.
I'm fascinated to know the hold that AC Milan has on the city itself, the city's culture, its heartbeat, the way the people go about their lives. I guess the football club's place in Milan, the city, what was that like? Can you describe it as a newcomer and someone who was there for a few years?
Well, it was obviously divided between Inter and Milan. They're football mad in Italy. That's their lives. That's their culture. So, you know, when someone supports a team, they support it from day dot till the end. And wherever you went around the city, you always, you know, I trained one day. I remember I trained, it was probably a couple of weeks in, and I was at training, and to be fair, I was shit at training, and I went to get a coffee at the bar where I lived, and the guy wouldn't serve me a coffee. And I said, "What do you mean?" And he goes, "Nah, you don't deserve a coffee the way you trained today."
No.
And I was like, "What are you on about, man?" And I got back to training the next day, and I said to him, I said, "Mate, the barista wouldn't give me a coffee because he said I trained shit." And they said, they watch all the training sessions, mate. You can't sleep here. If you don't perform, mate, they will give it to you. So I quickly learned that it was 100% performance every day, training, match, off field. There was no mucking around when you were at Milan. You always had to present yourself well and represent the club that you played for.
There's a time to be serious and a time to have a bit of a laugh. Did the locker room warm to your Aussie humour?
They loved it. Yeah, I think I was actually good for that dressing room because they were so they were perennial winners, right? So everything was about drive, 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 work, 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 and then they needed someone to maybe make the place a little bit lighthearted, and that was me. You know, I always had the jokes and the banter and take the mickey out of someone. Some of them didn't like it sometimes, so they get quite aggressive, a.k.a. Reno Gattuso would get quite aggressive when you took the mickey out of him, but all in good banter.
That won't surprise anyone, I don't reckon. but there were some characters in there too. I think Ronaldo, the Brazilian striker, arrived a fraction after you, but you'd learn that he knew how to celebrate, didn't he, Ronaldo?
He was a legend. He was, what a great guy he was. Ronnie was like just a great personality, a great player, and great person to have at training. And you know what? When you train with these guys, you watch them on TV and you go, geez, he's a good player. But then when you train with them every day, you actually go, he's not a good player. He's actually a great player because the things they could do, like, you know, Ronaldinho was like having a soccer ball and on a yo-yo string. Like it was scary, mate, the things they could do and how good. And when you played Sheva, you just didn't want to go in the middle because you got nutmegged about 50 times before you got out.
The things you must have seen at that training centre would boggle the mind. And playing under someone like Carlo Ancelotti, he looked like a hard man, a man with a strong presence. Was that what he was like? Was he all stick and no carrot, or was he also an arm around the shoulder as well?
No, complete opposite. He's a real player's manager, really easy to talk to. You know what I realised? The higher you go, and this is what I realised throughout my career, the higher you went, the more humble the people were and the harder they worked. It was like there was no individualism. There was no selfishness. It was all about the team, about winning, about performance, and about demanding from each other. And you didn't have to demand that much from them because they were playing at the highest level and they wanted to win. So they all worked hard, and he just tactically seemed to get it right constantly.
Can I ask about Athens 2007, the Champions League final against Liverpool? You did play a few matches in that campaign. You watch on, the team wins 2-1. I think Harry Kewell came off the bench in the second half for the Reds. But the occasion, the significance of it, a seventh title for AC Milan, what was that like to be part of?
Yeah, so I arrived in Milan the year they lost to Liverpool. So I arrived in the summer when they lost, and it was like a morgue. It really was like a morgue, and it was like, I remember the players even talking about, you know, it's finished, it's the end of an era, blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, Mr. Ancelotti, he just had this knack of getting everyone back up and running. And, you know, when you have that kind of quality of player, we ended up going to the semi-finals that year, and we ended up losing to Barcelona in the second leg where, mate, we were robbed because Shevchenko scored an equaliser in the 88th minute and they gave a foul on Puyol. And we ended up going away out to Barcelona, who ended up playing Arsenal in the final. And the following year, we were so hot. Oh, like that team was scary. I remember, I think we almost went out in the group stages and we had to win a game against Fenerbahce away from home. And we're having a topsy-turvy year in the competition. And we had to win against Fenerbahce, and we ended up winning 4-0 away. Sheva scored 4 goals, and that was it. The machine clicked, and we were unstoppable. Like that team, that club, as soon as the Champions League music come up, it was like a different beast. These players were just, man, they just grew. They were like Hercules. I swear to God, I can't explain it to you how good they were. Like, if anyone wants to watch a game of football, go watch 30 minutes of Milan against Man United in the return leg at the San Siro. And we absolutely toyed with them and just belted Living Daylights out of one of the best teams in the world at the time. And I thought to myself, how good is this team?
Oh, what a good cross that was. It's come out to Seydorf again. They might be in luck. This could be the goal that clinches it. And it is! Gilardino breaks clear and breaks United's hearts.
Yeah, what a joy to sit back and watch. You're listening to This Is Your Journey, thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Life with the Socceroos is up next with Jerko Kalac. We'll be back after this break.
You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. You're listening to This Is Your Journey with Sam Edmund for Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
It's been great to have your company here on This Is Your Journey, all thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, a family-owned business since 1934. And we've been joined today by one of Australia's best ever goalkeepers, Jerko Kalac. So, Spider, 14 years as a Socceroos goalkeeper, the records say, but only 54 caps. Should you have got more?
Oh, yeah, probably, but when you look at the amount of games that the Socceroos play now compared to in our generation, it was completely different. So, you know, I think a lot of our players, our generation of players, mate, would have got well over 100, 150 caps if it was the amount of games that, you know, if we were playing through Asia like the boys are now. So, yeah, more or less, it's the same. It was one of the best families I've ever been a part of. So it was a great 14 years for me.
But also some strong competition. So Mark Bosnich, Mark Schwarzer, who Frank Farina ended up opting for, and yourself. So honestly, as we sit here now in 2024, who was the better keeper out of the three of you?
I thought all three keepers had their own qualities. And you know, that's one thing that I talk a lot about now. So me, Bosler and Schwarzer are all 72 models. And people these days, they don't want competition. But look what competition does. We competed against each other since we were 10 years old.
Yeah.
And all three of us went on and played at the highest level. So competition drives you to be better in a good way, because, you know, Bozza wanted to be better than me and Schwartzy. I wanted to be better than them too. And Schwartzy wanted to be better than us too. So it drove us to be better goalkeepers. And we all got to the highest level through competition and hard work.
So the 2006 World Cup, the qualification, the tournament itself in Germany, I've been eager to ask you, did the way that Gus Hiddink managed yourself and Mark irritate both of you, one of you, the guessing games, the mind games, the uncertainty, did it irritate the two of you?
Thinking back at it now, I'm not really irritated by it now, so I don't know. But back then, yeah, I think we just both wanted to play. Like, I think we were both playing for our clubs at the time. We were both in great form. So it was just, I just want to play, you know, when you're used to playing. And at the end of the day, in the national team, someone has to play and someone has to sit on the bench. And you see that all over the world. You know, Brazil's got, you know, four or five great goalkeepers, but one only plays. So you just got to accept it. And I think when you're in the national team, you ended up accepting a lot of things to be a part of that squad.
And so were you able to have a friendly relationship with Mark, or did the competitive tension between the two of you make that too difficult?
I think we were both competitive. I mean, don't forget, me and Schwartzy competed against each other since we were 10 years old. So we knew each other for a long time. You know, obviously, I think it was probably we all had our own egos as professional footballers as well, and we all believed we were the dog's bollocks and that I should be playing, and that's how it was. So it was an ego driven sport, and we just wanted to play. So I think that competitiveness throughout our whole careers drove us anyway.
Yeah, no, you need that ego, absolutely. And did you find yourself trying to read Gus? I mean, was he a hard man to read, or you just were happy with living in a, I don't know, relative state of uncertainty? Or were you always trying to work out what he was thinking?
Well, there's no point trying to read him because he kept his cards very close to his chest. And you know what I learned about hitting? He always done what he thought was right for the team.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's something that you learn along your journey in football. Whether you think it's right or wrong, you just accept it. I mean, Frankie Farina was probably the one. Me and Frankie worked together at Sydney FC, and he was a coach and I was a goalkeeper coach. And I said to Frankie, I said, mate, you probably cost me about 50 caps in the Socceroos since you come in. Mate, I never played. You know, it was just a choice. It's a manager's choice. It's someone that he felt more comfortable with or showed loyalty towards. And if that person didn't let him down, they just kept on playing.
And Hiddink wasn't one to die wondering, was he? So the second leg of the Uruguay World Cup qualifier, obviously a famous night in the history of Australian football that will live on forever. You're told to warm up. Was it about 10 minutes maybe before the end of extra time? You're definitely coming on to replace Mark Schwarzer for the shootout. And then the fittest guy in the squad, it'd have to have been, Brett Emmerton gets cramp and Gus is forced to use his final substitution.
Mate, that's destiny. That's just the way life goes. That's destiny. That's the way things pan out. And Schwartzy ends up making two or three fantastic saves, and mate, the rest is history. So, you know, you look back at it, what could have been? But I'm not much of a what could have been man. I always look forward, and that was our destiny. And that team deserved to go to a World Cup because we've been through so much pain together.
Yep.
And it was probably our last opportunity together. And, you know, we were probably all at the peak of our careers at that time. So to finally qualify, I didn't care how we got in. You know, the main thing was that we qualified, and the good of the game and football in this country went mad. It was a great, great night.
Has to be one of the best moments in the history of Australian sport, I would argue. One of the saves that Schwarzer ended up making was a cracker. It was Marcelo Zalajeta, who you played with at Perugia. And this might have been the save to Schwarzer's left. The big right
Correct.
Mitt comes up. So
Correct.
Your intel for that, your intel for Dario Rodriguez, for other players you were familiar with, you know, you might have been upset that you couldn't come on. But here you are providing the critical information for Mark to make the saves.
Yeah, but you still got to make them. You know, I can tell him which way he's going to go, but you still got to make the saves. And I think the penalty save against Zalajeta was a cracker. You know, like as he actually hits it
yep.
in a nice position at a decent height, but with power. So you know, you still got to make them. It's pretty easy to say when someone says, oh, you're going to go to your right, but you still got to make the save.
How do you reflect? And I hope it gets easier for you over time, because I can't imagine how many times you've been asked about it. The Niko Kovac goal in the last group game against Croatia.
Crowd roar every time they think there might be a shot on, and there is a shot on here. What a mistake made by the goalkeeper. Niko Kovac restores the lead for Croatia, but horror for goalkeeper Kalac, the one who's been brought in for Mark Schwarzer tonight. His mind will be racing.
Firstly, how many times have you been asked about it? How tired are you of answering it? And now, does it bother you at all? Does it live on and bug you at all?
No, it doesn't live on and bug me anymore. It's one of those moments in football. And to be fair, you see a lot of mistakes by goalkeepers in the modern game that I think to myself, mate, how did they make those mistakes? But then when I think about some of the mistakes I made in my career as well.
When you're playing for that long,
it's part and parcel of the job, ain't it?
That's it. When you're playing for that long, you're going to get those. I guess I was interested, though. I rewatched it this morning, and look, I'm not sure how it lives on with you, but mentally, how difficult was it in that moment to process it, overcome it? I mean, it was in the 56th minute of the game. There was so much football left. 2-1 down, need to draw or better to go through to the round of 16. So overcoming it mentally, how difficult was that?
Yeah, but that's, I think, this is probably a good question for younger players, younger generation. So as a goalkeeper, I didn't reach the pinnacle in football because I worried about mistakes. So when you actually make a mistake, you actually need to put that to the side ASAP. It's done. You cannot change it. You know, what happened 10 seconds ago, I cannot change anymore. All I need to make sure is that I don't make another mistake. And that's how it was in my whole career. It was mistakes being done, whatever's been done, I can't take that back. Make sure the next decision is the right decision. And, you know, throughout these players who play at the highest level in any sport will tell you what's done is done. Concentrate on what has to happen.
And you did. And I'm not sure if Harry Kewell was a drinker, but did you get him a couple of beers after that? Because, gee, we did.
I think we had a few mouth fresheners, yeah.
He pulled you out of the fire, didn't he, with that goal? Jeez, awesome. I wanted to ask you just quickly, actually, you saw the Italian game in the round of 16, the Grosso penalty. Was it there?
Yeah, it's a hard one. That's one for Lucas to talk to. Look, mate. You could give it and you couldn't give it. You know, it was one of those. But I'll be honest with you, playing in Italy for 10 years and knowing exactly what the Italian players are waiting for, he was waiting for Lucas to go down. As soon as Lucas went down, he knew exactly what he was going to do. So, you know, the game's changed a lot since then. VAR would have come into play. So who knows if they would have got it right or wrong as well with that VAR.
Never a great way to bow out of a World Cup. But when you haven't been there for so long, and the manner in which defeat you experienced, I can't imagine how gut-wrenching that was for the squad in the moment in Germany after that.
Yeah, it was. It was a bit of pill to swallow, especially with the way we were playing. And, you know, we thought, I think the next game, if we went through there, was against Ukraine, which we thought we could win as well. So it could have been a miracle run for Australia because the squad we had was so strong that people have no idea how strong that team was. I think there was 18 players who played in the top five leagues in Europe. I would love to see the next Australian team that can have a squad of players that play at that level.
I'm glad you mentioned that. This is where I wanted to end. The amount of Socceroos playing in the big divisions around the world, we're obviously internationally and on the biggest stage, we like to think we punch well above our weight, but we're not in the biggest leagues anymore, certainly not at that level like you mentioned. Why is that, do you think?
Well, look, I don't know. I think the generation's changed. The game has changed. Do I think this younger generation have the opportunity to be better players? 100%, because they have more resources, they have better facilities than what we had. Infrastructure is much better than what we had. But I always question that burning desire inside of them. Like, we always had this burning desire to win. A lot of this generation, they don't care whether they win or lose. Honestly, a lot of them will go to work and be a footballer because they're getting paid. You know, we were the lucky ones who got paid, but we actually love the game. I question whether a lot of these players love the game.
So it's hunger as much more over than talent, do you think?
100%. 100%. Well, mate, let me just put it to you. You have a look at these younger generation when you ask them to run without the ball. Mate, they moan and they cry and they do everything. But running, my friend, is a part of the game. And if you can't run in football these days, you cannot play at the highest level. You know, they think Manchester City just go out and spend this ridiculous amount of players on players who can play football. Let me give you the tip. Every Manchester City player can run like a dog at high speed and repeat sprint.
Jako Kalac, thanks so much for joining us today, mate. 366 games for your clubs, 54 games for your country, Champions League titles, World Cup matches. It's been an incredible journey that's taken you all around the world. Great to see you now also giving back and developing what is hopefully the next generation of talent to do Australia proud on a global scale. Well done on everything you've achieved. It's certainly been and is a life well lived. Thanks for sharing some of it with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to This Is Your Journey for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. You can find them online, tobinbrothers.com.au, and we'll catch you the next time we celebrate another great sporting journey.